The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored, so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, The Rebirth of Rural Healthcare. UNC Health's Chatham Hospital is developing a business model that may revive rural hospitals nationwide. And the story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, The Rebirth of Rural Healthcare. UNC Chatham Hospital adds a maternity center as part of its effort to revitalize healthcare in rural North Carolina. And this is written by Connie Gentry. UNC Chatham Hospital was thrilled to meet Carter James Hubbard when he was born January 11. His parents, Matthew and Lacey Hubbard of Pittsboro, had traveled to Chapel Hill for the birth of their first two children, but Carter arrived in the new maternity center in Siler City. This birth was such a wonderful experience, Lacey Hubbard says. We live about 12 minutes from Chatham Hospital, and the facility is beautiful. It didn't feel like a baby factory. Not that I had bad experiences before, but I really like the smaller size and the personal touch, Hubbard adds. Carter's arrival also symbolizes a rebirth for the rural hospital, and one UNC Health is hoping to replicate elsewhere. Chatham Hospital, which traces its roots to 1938 when it started in a two-bedroom house with pigs in the backyard, is very much the prototypical rural hospital found across the U.S. A new hospital rose in 1950 as America boomed in the years after World War II. There were physician providers and a significant birthing center with midwives from the late 70s until 1991, when they lost their physician backup and the midwives moved to Chapel Hill and opened the Women's Birth and Wellness Center, explains Dr. Andrew Hannapel, chief medical officer at UNC Chatham Hospital. It was a familiar trajectory as rural communities struggled to retain health care options. Since 2005, 176 rural hospitals have closed across the U.S., including 11 in North Carolina. Among those were the Good Hope Hospital in Irwin, which served Harnett County, and Novant Health Franklin Medical Center in Lewisburg, which has since reopened as an emergency care center. But in Siler City, UNC Health is trying to stem that tide and, in fact, to define a new model for rural health. The system bought Chatham Hospital for $11.3 million in 2008, the same year the hospital opened its current building. In September, UNC Health opened the 5-bed Maternity Care Center at an initial investment of $2.6 million and anticipated operating costs of $3 million per year. The hospital doesn't expect the maternity ward to be profitable for a few years, and the hospital overall was already losing about $1 million a year before the pandemic strained it even further. But UNC Health sees a promising start for the maternity ward and for the expansion of family practice throughout the county. A unique aspect of UNC's approach is that its doctors also work in the community clinics, where they see newborns, children, adolescents, and adults. This is the overarching objective behind the maternity care center. Providing prenatal and family care at the community clinics adds a level of continuity and a degree of relationship with the patients before and after they come and birth with us, says Dr. Dana Iglesias, medical director of the Maternity Care Center. As of January 13, 43 babies had been delivered at the Maternity Care Center, and the hospital is on track to meet its first-year goal of delivering 12 babies a month. We recognized Chatham County was a maternity desert, so we wanted to carve out a portion of beds for labor and delivery, says Dr. Jeffrey Stickler, president of Chatham Hospital. Although UNC's main hospital in Chapel Hill was the destination for many of the maternity calls, healthcare professionals knew it would be better for patients to deliver locally. UNC Health has its mission to deliver as much care as we can at the local level, Strickler says, but our biggest mission is to see if this model can work in rural hospitals around the country. A big investment. The Maternity Care Center, which caters to low-risk deliveries, which was a much-needed addition to the county, which sees around 700 births a year. But if UNC Health's model for returning health care to rural communities is to prove sustainable, it must have financial merit. Sustainable success, however, is not necessarily synonymous with profitability at the hospital level. UNC Chatham Hospital is designated as a critical access hospital, or CAH, meaning it is reimbursed by Medicare at cost plus 1%, and it is capped at 25 beds. The CAH designation was intended to keep hospitals in rural communities, so UNC Health committed to invest in a new facility that was smaller, but that includes an emergency department, an operating room, and various support services, including a lab and imaging, Strickler says. About half of our patients are in a post-acute status where they need continued rehab services, so they spend additional weeks with us. That's been the business model. Nick Galvez, manager at the NC Department of Health and Human Services Office of Rural Health, notes, of the 20 CAH-designated hospitals in the state, 80% are part of a large healthcare system, and the remaining four are county or community-owned, and that's a factor as to their long-term survivability. Larger institutions have been known to shut down the smaller rural hospitals they've acquired because they're deemed a financial burden. In its fiscal year 20 audit report, Chatham Hospital noted operating revenue at $34.6 million and operating expenses at $36.9 million, a shortfall of $2.3 million. Historically, we've lost about $1 million annually, but the losses increased this year because of opening the new maternity care center and the challenges posed by the pandemic, Strickler says. However, UNC Health has committed to the broader mission of providing better health outcomes locally and greater efficiencies across the system. Hannipal says, at UNC Chatham Hospital, the idea is that being in a larger healthcare system is not only beneficial for us at a critical access hospital, but also beneficial to the larger UNC system because there are downstream effects to the healthcare system of handling things locally as opposed to everyone going to the larger community hospital. It is an avenue in which a system can have smaller hospitals that are seen as an asset, but not as a burden. Assets to provide care to their constituency in the area, especially as we go to the value-based payment system where hospitals are paid by population, not by procedure. For the maternity care center, the break-even point for when the added services show a financial return for UNC Health will be in 3 or 4 years when they have scaled to 350 deliveries a year. The business model is designed to attract patients to Chatham Hospital for a range of services, not just maternity, but everything from preventative screenings to surgeries to rehab services and physical therapy. It's a very intentional strategy so people don't drive out of the county for basic care, Strickler says. The UNC Health Strategic Plan and long-term business model for Chatham Hospital is a step toward sustainable, successful operations. Having an intentional plan is key to the success of small rural hospitals, says Brock Slabach, Senior Vice President of the National Rural Health Association. Many communities are looking at affiliation with larger medical systems like UNC Health to help with their operations, but that's not always a silver bullet, Slabach says. The system affiliation needs to be developed out of a strong strategic plan for the hospital, for the rural hospital, one that fills the gaps that the local hospital cannot do for itself. If Chatham Hospital had to develop its own family medicine program and bring in providers, Hannipal says it would not be successful. It would be too hard, too expensive, and it would never make direct money. A broader challenge. A significant piece of this UNC Health model is that the family physicians in the community clinics address comprehensive health needs for all ages, as well as chronic disease like diabetes, COPD, and heart disease. And the other significant piece is that we actively recruit providers who look like their patients, says Hannipal. His last point is particularly relevant in Siler City, where the demographics skew heavily to minorities, 46.5% Latinx, 26.5% white, and 20.8% black. There are about 53 rural hospitals in the state, including 20 that are designated critical access hospitals and 11 that are classified as small rural hospitals, which can have up to 49 beds. Shakira McCoy, Director of Rural Health Innovation at North Carolina Healthcare Association, wants to explore how resources might be shared to create a greater ROI for hospital operations. There are unique challenges in rural health care, but we don't want to focus on those exclusively and detract from the positive aspects like the close-knit feeling where everyone knows and supports each other, she says. We're looking at where the gaps are across communities and perhaps how to create payment parity through telehealth. Margaret Maggie Sauer, director of the NCDHHS Office of Rural Health, says the challenges of recruiting and retaining providers are largely impacted by the infrastructure and economic development of the area. She points to the availability of broadband or internet connectivity or lack thereof as one of the most striking disparities in rural communities. Telehealth is a huge opportunity for rural health, but it's not possible in many of our rural areas, she says. If you look at a map of North Carolina and who has broadband, if one person has access, it looks like everybody has access, but that's not the case. Broadband provides access to job development, and often when you're bringing providers into rural communities, two people, the provider and their spouse or partner, need to be employed. And if they have children, the quality of schools and education are important. The overall community impacts more than the quality of life and ability to attract providers. It is the foundation on which the success of rural hospitals may live or close. In some cases where we've seen hospitals closing, we found out they didn't engage the county managers or economic development folks soon enough. They wait until the hospital is about to shut down and then push the emergency button, Sauer says. Chatham County is among the more proactive. Chatham County Public Health Director Mike Zelick says, we consider all the social determinants, looking beyond just health care at the bigger outcomes, and we do a community assessment process to prioritize areas that need work. In their 2018 assessment, one of the key areas to address was poverty. We're looking at economic opportunity, education, from K through 12 to community colleges and workforce development. We're all trying to come together to make a difference, Zelick adds. Challenged by COVID. Community engagement has been even more important over the last year as COVID-19 has stressed the resources across all of healthcare, increasingly so at rural hospitals. Chatham Hospital was impacted early in the pandemic when a coronavirus cluster erupted in the community among workers at a food processing plant. At that time, Strickler says the hospital was 50% filled with COVID-positive patients. In December, the hospital was 30% filled with COVID-positive patients. In mid-January, Zelick said, Chatham doesn't look as bad as other areas in the state, but COVID is as bad now as it's ever been, with cases rising. In terms of long-term impacts, the pandemic has delayed or stretched out some of our planned discussions because all of the competing priorities, but we are continuing with those conversations. The CDC highlights that a rural community's ability or inability to respond to COVID-19 has been greatly influenced by challenged resources and lagging infrastructure. Specifically, CDC notes that emergency medical services in rural settings often rely on volunteers. There is a shortage of health professionals providing primary care. The public health departments in rural areas often serve large geographic regions, further straining resources, and widespread use of telemedicine is not possible because broadband and internet communications are either unavailable or unreliable. The solution going forward, Sauer says, is our ability to work together across county lines and throughout the state. We have to move to a regional approach for how we work together. If we don't pay attention to rural communities and look at what's happening regionally, we are really creating some self-imposed barriers, she says. And now we turn to the continuing series, The Promise Of. The headline, Offering a Lifeline to the Ones in Need, How Evelyn Sanders Has Evolved Her Raleigh-Based Healthcare Business and Expanded Its Relevant Offerings. Story by Connie Gentry. About this project, the project name is based on a historical reference relating to Union Army leader William Sherman's promise of giving 40 acres to slaves after the Civil War. That promise, which came to be known as 40 acres and a mule, never came through as President Andrew Johnson rescinded the order after taking office. Resiliency and optimism have helped pave the way for Evelyn Sanders and the healthcare services she's provided to Wake County residents for going on 30 years. Every time you think you're down and out, a lifeline comes along, she says. Not every social worker turned entrepreneur would have had the initiative or the insight to grab on to the lifelines she's attached to her business. A perfect example, COVID-19 restrictions all but decimated the adult daycare and overnight respite care aspects of the organization Sanders leads, Southeastern Healthcare of North Carolina. Those restrictions roughly cut revenue in half from 2019 to 2020, when its fee-for-service income fell from $2 million to $1.2 million. The lifeline she grabbed most recently, pivoting in 2020 to add a clinical laboratory services, and it's an area that is now gaining momentum. Recently, the Wake County Health Department came over to see if we could help with TB testing, since they're overwhelmed with COVID testing and not able to keep up with the TB tests, Sanders says. It's a good fit, and they've already started sending folks to us for TB tests. Formerly a social worker with Rex Home Care, Sanders had worked across the southern and southeastern areas of Raleigh, where she realized there were very few services available for adult care. Primarily, there were nursing homes and assisted living facilities. After researching alternative services, she and her husband started Southeastern Healthcare of North Carolina in 1991 to provide adult daycare services. Initially licensed for 12 adults, it quickly expanded to 18. By 1995, when the business relocated to a larger facility, they were licensed for 40 adults and had grown from being primarily an adult social program to include a health program with medicine management and healthcare monitoring. The majority of our participants had multiple needs, mobility issues, hypertension, diabetes, cardiovascular illnesses, COPD, and quite a few had dementia, Sanders says. The next year, 1996, we added home care and personal care services, which meant we could help our participants meet daily needs like bathing, dressing, cooking, and keeping their space safe and clean. The business grew. In 2002, it added services for disabled veterans. And in 2006, opened a psychosocial rehabilitation division. 2013 was a banner year. They moved into their current 15,000-square-foot facility, started offering overnight respite care, and began performing employee health screenings and services for other businesses. We've had many challenges, but have continuously redefined and realigned ourselves to meet the challenges of staying in business and staying in business as a minority company, Sanders says. In 2019, they closed a second location that had opened in Clayton in 2010. Although it was more profitable to operate the Clayton site because of lower overhead, the business could not sustain the two locations. Our mission is to improve the quality of life for disabled adults and the frail elderly and to help prevent premature institutionalization of adults, Sanders explains. We continuously assess the needs of our population and the community so we can provide services based on those needs. Peer support services were added in 2015, providing an avenue for people who have recovered from substance abuse or mental health challenges to provide support for others. In 2019, Sanders added a similar model, bringing in community health workers to augment the business. These are trusted, knowledgeable individuals who work in the community, she says. Earlier this month, the Center for Healthcare Strategies, a nonprofit policy center dedicated to improving the health of low-income residents in all 50 states, published a brief that clarifies the value and meaning of this workforce. Community-based organizations and healthcare systems are increasingly supporting staff whose most powerful credentials are their own personal knowledge and experiences. These workers have a variety of titles: community health worker, promotora, health navigator, health coach, and community outreach worker, among others. But the common threads that link them are their close ties to the communities where they both live and work, and the experiences that they share with the people they serve. The CHCS report concluded community health workers with lived experiences can improve outcomes for patients who are being cared for in the home or outside of a healthcare setting. Services provided by community health workers have been demonstrated to be effective and to improve health outcomes across a wide range of patient needs, as Sanders explains. Our program of using community health workers is ideal to help improve the accessibility and affordability of care to meet the health needs of marginalized individuals. At its peak, Southeastern Healthcare of NC had 157 home care clients, as well as operated its on-site facility at full capacity. A typical day pre-pandemic would see 120 people being served at the facility. Now, given COVID restrictions, the most they can serve on any given day is 16 people. On the adult daycare side of the business, which operates as a nonprofit, the demographics skew largely to women, who represent 67%, and minorities, only 4% are white. The majority of our participants are African-American women, but we're getting more Latinx folks because of our community outreach, Sanders notes. On the psychosocial rehab side, a for-profit entity, it's an entirely different story. Sanders says the majority are male, 52% are white, 44% black, and the remaining 4% are split between Latinx and Asian. There was a time before 9/11 that it was nothing for us to get a $10,000 donation from one of the big companies in RTP. But after 9/11 happened, the donations for small nonprofits dried up, and we had to find other ways to generate money, Sanders says. But now, she isn't looking for donations. She's looking for business partners and opportunities to provide services to some of the major employers and insurance companies in the area. What I want the major insurance providers to know is that we can do all the testing in our offices that can be done in other labs or primary care physician offices. I'd love to talk with Blue Cross and Blue Shield and United Healthcare about working with us, Sanders says. And we also have a couple of news items in the Promise Of section. NCCU and TikTok promote careers in healthcare. North Carolina Central University is one of 10 academic institutions receiving $1 million donation from TikTok to provide scholarships for students who are pursuing degrees in healthcare, public health, or medical fields. The NCCU scholarships will be awarded to students from underrepresented groups who are studying medicine, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and who plan to pursue careers in medicine, science, biotechnology, or pharmaceutical industries. This investment will ensure our students who aspire to serve on the front lines of care can complete their education and pursue solutions for some of the most challenging medical issues confronting our society, including COVID-19, said NCCU Chancellor Johnson Akinley. The university also promotes careers in health sciences through its Julius L. Chambers Biomedical Biotechnology Research Institute, which conducts research focused on health issues that disproportionately affect minority and underserved populations. The TikTok scholarship donations followed the company's presentation of $150 million to the Health Heroes Relief Fund in 2020. SHRM study reveals workplace culture. At a recent inclusion conference hosted by the Society of Human Resource Management, or SHRM, attendees learned that 33% of U.S. workers say their workplaces discourage discussions of racial justice issues. Research from SHRM also revealed that 25% of Americans don't feel respected and valued at work. One in five workers have left a job due to workplace culture, and one in two HR professionals say inclusivity exists in the workplace. The 2020 conference was a virtual event attended by 1,200 diversity, equity, and inclusion leaders who met to address the importance of building inclusive workplace cultures. Inclusion 2021 will be held October 25 through 27 in Austin, Texas. Details will be determined at a later date on in-person versus virtual attendance. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. The first headline, From Cool Idea to Thriving Business. A Raleigh mom with a simple concept, help people get produce from local farmers, has turned the idea into a thriving business with customers across North Carolina. Courtney Tellefson had worked in athletics clubs owned by John Kane and then for Marbles Museum before starting the Produce Box in 2008. She found 25 families, mostly in her Quail Hollow neighborhood in Raleigh, and picked up the produce and delivered it around. The idea exploded. Soon, people in Briar Creek and other parts of the city were interested. I'm like, I'm not going to do that. I've got two kids, Tellefson says. But she soon realized, maybe I could make something of this. Tellefson did not go to college and had no business background, but soon began to figure out systems to receive and deliver the food. She had 1,000 families the second year and now has 15,000 customers stretching from Wilmington to Charlotte. She gets produce from 75 farmers and has 75 artisan vendors. Our mission from the beginning has been to get as much produce in the hands of North Carolinians as humanly possible, Tellefson says. She has 80 employees at a Raleigh warehouse and another 180, mostly mothers who want a part-time job, deliver the produce. We make enough profit every year to pay everybody's salary and usually give a bonus and invest back in the company, Tellefson says. I'm not interested in building this bazillion-dollar company. I'm just letting it happen. Despite pandemic, North Hills sees surge of development. 2020 was a big year at North Hills in Raleigh despite the pandemic. Kane Realty Corporation's mixed-use destination continued its explosive growth with new towers rising and new plans for development. The company opened the Vine Apartments last year, the first phase of the newly announced $1 billion North Hills Innovation District. In the fall, the 20-story Advance Auto Parts Tower debuted with additional tenants, including IAT Insurance. 2020 was also the start of such projects as the Walter Tower, a 35-story residential tower to be completed in 2020. A number of new tenants announced or signed on to new space at North Hills, including Jabala Coffee, the Barbecue Lab, and Cucciolo Terrazza, among others. Restoration Hardware also plans an RH Gallery. This year, Kane has a number of projects in the works, including a $350 million revitalization plan for the main district where the former JCPenney store stands. Meredith names new executive. Meredith College has named a leader with an extensive background in education to the key role of Vice President for Business and Finance. Tammy Jackson succeeds Craig Barfield, who retired after 9 years. Her philosophy that a college's business and finance division exists to help support the academic development of students was evident throughout the interview process, Meredith President Joe Allen says. Meredith has been bolstered by the Beyond Strong campaign that raised $90.5 million. Its annual operating budget is $52.3 million. Tar Heels flocked to state parks in 2020. What Governor Roy Cooper called a comfort in a time of isolation, North Carolina state parks experienced a record number of visitors in calendar year 2020. According to the state parks office, parks and recreation areas across the state saw 19.8 million visitors last year, 400,000 more than any other year on record, and 1.2 million more visitors than in 2019. The previous record for visitation was set in 2017 when the parks welcomed 19.4 million visitors. Park staff attribute the increased visitation not only to public recognition that outdoor recreation promotes better health during the pandemic, but also to recently completed Connect NC Bond projects at parks across the state. These projects include improved and expanded campground facilities, new trails and visitor centers, and improved parking and access. Despite the majority of parks being closed for weeks at the outset of the pandemic, 28 state parks and recreation areas reported increases in visitation in 2020. We like our balance here in the Triangle. A new survey from Smart Asset shows that 72% of Americans consider work-life balance to be an important factor when selecting a job. And that's good news for the Triangle, as both Durham and Raleigh cracked the top 25 cities of Smart Asset's rankings of cities by work-life balance. Durham ranked 9th and Raleigh 16th. Durham, the report noted, has average commutes of 22.6 minutes, the 25th lowest time spent traveling to work. But there is room for improvement, as Durham finished in the bottom 10% when it came to walkability. And finally, it's Tiger on the phone with news for you. Kudos to Davis Love III, the former UNC Chapel Hill star, named captain of the U.S. President's Cup team for 2022 at Quail Hollow Club in Charlotte. Love, a native of Charlotte, has 21 PGA Tour victories. He told Charlotte Business Journal that Tiger Woods, the 2019 captain, called him with the news. "We've been talking about this for years and years, so when Tiger called me in late December and said, 'Hey, you're going to be President's Cup captain,' I was surprised, but it didn't come out of the blue," he said. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Tech and Aviation page, written by Lauren Onasorge. First headline, Yusko's bet on SPACs. What does Yusko have in common with Shaq? SPACs, of course. Mark Yusko, the former investment manager for UNC Chapel Hill, does not want to be left behind when it comes to the new and shiny thing on Wall Street. Why should he? If it's good for NBA star Shaquille O'Neal and hedge fund manager Bill Ackman, it must be good for him too, right? Yusko and other money managers and institutional investors have a new toy to play with to raise money and do deals, a Special Purpose Acquisition Company, or SPAC, a source of financing private companies are using to go public. Yusko's Morgan Creek Capital Management in Chapel Hill is teaming up with Exos Financial to launch the SPAC ETF, and it's targeting investments in firms that have already gone public through SPAC deals and shell firms still looking for acquisitions. Nearly 300 SPACs are now seeking deals, armed with about $90 billion in cash. If you look at the SPAC structure, it's far superior a way of going public for any company that has a lot of high growth and a lot of potential, but maybe not a lot of revenue, he says, pointing to past SPAC deals in areas such as space travel and electric cars. There may not be a lot of revenue today, but there's a huge potential. These are great growth companies of tomorrow. SPACs, or blank check companies, don't actually have commercial operations. Instead, they are firms designed to raise capital through an initial public offering in order to engage in a merger, acquisition, reorganization, or other business combination. By offering specifically targeted SPACs, it's allowing investors to hedge their bets, Yusko says. There are going to be some big winners, he says. Unlike Morgan Creek's legacy products, those winners could include unaccredited investors. Every investor can invest in this, Yusko says. The fund marks the third time Morgan Creek has teamed up with Exos, which it also invested in through its Blockchain Opportunity Fund. Exos, a digital investment bank run by former CEO of Credit Suisse, Brady Williams-Dugan, is a longtime acquaintance of Yusko's. But there are risks, and they fall on the side of the investors, not the target companies. Larry Robbins, a partner at Raleigh law firm Wyrick Robbins, Yates & Ponton, notes that for target companies, SPAC buys can be an attractive option. With a SPAC, they're not required to go through a roadshow and make presentations all over the country where somebody behind a curtain number three decides what the price of the company is going to be. Durham firm pours dollars into coastal tech startup. A startup investment firm born from the $200 million exit for Bronto Software is deploying millions to a small software firm on the coast. Durham-based Jurassic Capital, the brainchild of Bronto founder Joe Colopy, has funneled nearly $3 million into Performance Culture Holdings of Wilmington. For Colopy, whose firm sold NetSuite, now Oracle, without collecting a single dollar of venture capital back in 2015, the investment is about paying it forward. I received a lot from Bronto, and now I'm dishing it back out, Colopy says. Colopy and his partner at Jurassic, Kevin Mosley, are targeting their capital toward innovators in the Southeast, firms just like Performance Culture Holdings. PCH was founded in 2015 by Melissa Philippi and Dallas Romanowski as the software complement to Culture Coaching. Colopy says the full amount actually came from Jurassic. He says the money gleaned from Bronto isn't all he plans to funnel into the firm. It's about the recycling of dollars and, more importantly, the recycling of expertise, Colopy says. That's what Silicon Valley has done. That's what Boston has done. We need more of that in the Triangle. And in a section called He Said It, a quote from Mike Walden, NC State University economist, making a prediction for Raleigh-Durham International Airport shortly after budget carrier Sun Country Airlines of Minneapolis announced plans to add RDU to its network in May. Low-cost airlines will be looking to expand, while the big airlines are still struggling. And also a quote from IBM CEO Arvind Krishna, speaking as Big Blue reported, $73.6 billion in 2020 revenue, down 5%, even as Red Hat revenue rose 18%. In the midst of all this, I'm seeing an even greater need for clients to accelerate their digital transformations, and this bodes very well for us now and over the long term. As I've told you before, the opportunity in hybrid cloud and AI is enormous. And finally, a big number, 66%. The data is in, Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority CEO Mike Landguth said this month, and amid a trying and challenging year, the airport served 4.9 million total passengers in 2020. That's a 66% decline from 2019. The last time RDU hit numbers that low was 1987. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Caleb Harshberger. Big plans for North Hills. Kane plans $1 billion innovation district with a food hall. Kane Realty has announced its latest big project for North Hills, a $1 billion innovation district aimed at capitalizing on the region's growing status as a life sciences hub. The Raleigh company unveiled its plan for the 33-acre North Hills Innovation District on January 25 to be located between St. Albans Drive and Interstate 440. The first phase of the project, Kane's Vine North Hills Apartments, was completed late last year. Additional phases will include the 18-story Class A office building, North Hills Tower 5, the 200-unit Class A Channel House Apartments, and the two-story 20,000-square-foot Big Branch Food Hall, the company says. CEO John Kane says the company plans to emphasize local tenants and businesses as it looks to lease out the space. Local businesses are the lifeblood of all successful communities, but especially here in Raleigh, Kane says. As NHID comes to life, we want to harness the entrepreneurial spirit of local business owners and offer them a space in North Hills to make their dreams a reality. The Innovation District adds to Kane's decades-long development of North Hills. Last fall, the company unveiled a $350 million revitalization plan for North Hills' main district. The plan is to redevelop the area, including the former JCPenney store. Plans call for a high-rise residential building, 100,000 square feet of ground floor retail, and 346,000 square feet of office space across 5 and 10-story buildings. Kane has also recently announced new retailers and restaurants for North Hills. Phase 2 of construction will begin on the Innovation District this summer, the company said, starting with Channel House. Work on North Hills Tower 5 is expected to start in late fall. Phase 3 is scheduled to break ground in 2022. The company said the project will include an unprecedented amount of green space, outdoor retail and dining, and connection to the Capital Area Greenway system and pedestrian walkways. The development is bisected by Big Branch Creek. The project will continue the dramatic overhaul of that part of the city. Also on the rise is the $1 billion Midtown Exchange project of DeWitt Carolinas, which will be right down St. Albans Drive. We hope that Tower 5 and all of NHID will become home to innovative, forward-thinking companies that value employee satisfaction, originality, and a culturally enriched urban area, Kane says. All of North Hills, and especially this new district, is ideally located, immediately accessible from I-440 and minutes from downtown Raleigh, RDU Airport, and Research Triangle Park. Highwoods buys out office park partner. Highwoods Properties has gained full ownership of a large office park in Raleigh after buying out its ownership partner. The Raleigh-based REIT, or REIT, bought out Germany-based Ballantis Real Estate AG's 75% interest in the Forum in North Raleigh for $131.3 million, according to a release from Highwoods. The Forum is a five-building, 636,000-square-foot office complex, currently valued at $184.5 million, including $9.5 million of planned near-term building improvements. Highwoods says the property is situated at 8521 Six Forks Road in Raleigh, just south of Strickland Road. The site is made up of five parcels. Altogether, the buildings are 91% occupied. Highwoods now has full ownership of the office campus and will continue handling management and leasing for the property. The Forum is a Class A portfolio with a proven track record of strong performance. With its diverse base of walkable amenities, proximity to housing, and excellent access to major thoroughfares, the Forum is in a highly desirable office location in the North Raleigh submarket, said Ted Klink, Highwoods president and CEO. We and our joint venture partner first acquired the Forum in 2008. As a result, we know the property well and believe the long-term return outlook is solid, which made this incremental investment a natural fit for us. David Finger and Sarah Owen of Cushman & Wakefield Raleigh-Durham office, along with David Moline and Samir Idris of the firm's Atlanta office, provided capital markets advisory services over the past 3 years, culminating with the partial ownership sale. New homes planned near downtown Cary Park. A residential development with dozens of new homes could soon be in the works in downtown Cary. The owners of a trio of parcels near the downtown Cary Park project have filed a rezoning request for up to 31 townhomes or 50 multi-family dwellings. The property is situated on 2.3 acres directly east of Cary Elementary School. Park Point development in RTP signs major tenant. A massive campus in Research Triangle Park has secured its latest tenant amid a major redevelopment project. Developer Trinity Capital Advisors of Charlotte recently said Massachusetts-based Charles River Laboratories Incorporated has signed on as a tenant at Park Point, taking up 70,369 square feet on the first and second floors in the park's three-story Edge West building. And finally, a section called Big Number, $15.8 million. That's how much Maryland's Broadreach Retail Partners LLC paid for the Avent Ferry Shopping Center in Southwest Raleigh. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Triangle Housing Market Needs a Cold Shower. A real estate land broker friend of mine told me recently that one of his neighbors listed their home for sale and received 40 offers within 3 days, with many of them bidding higher than the asking price. If you're a homeowner, you may think that's great, unless, of course, you are planning to sell your existing home and trying to find something else in the area. Good luck with that. According to the Triangle Area Residential Realty, a Cary Housing Data Research Company run by Stacy Anfinson, the Triangle housing market activity in December was higher in almost every category when compared to the same month in 2019. Mind you, 2020 was a COVID-19 year, and it still beat the numbers. For example, showings were up 25%. 34% of the homes sold for more than the listed price. The average sales price increased 11%, and average resale prices increased 14%. And days on the market for listed homes was 40, down from 55 in 2019. The rock-bottom interest rates may be the biggest culprit in the market, staying hot across many parts of the country, but increasing apartment rents in our communities may also be forcing millennials to buy real estate rather than rent. Any way you look at it, this super-hot environment is not healthy for the long-term health of the Raleigh-Durham housing ecosphere. What makes matters worse is that the effort from our city and town leaders in Raleigh and Apex to address and provide affordable housing is likely to fall flat on its face because the market simply won't find it feasible to support the affordable housing initiative unless cities and towns start pouring some of the taxpayer dollars into developing homes. In a COVID year, local municipalities don't have that kind of disposable dollars. We're writing something on it in the next few days. So what do we do? We are still seeing 43 people move into our communities every day and 21 born each day. Zonda, a market research firm, notes new home construction closings increased 14% in 2020, and in 2021 it is expected to increase another 16%. What must happen now is that towns and cities approve site plans at a record pace because delayed permits for these new subdivisions are slowing the process even more. That's creating a bottleneck for buyers looking to move into new homes, says Zonda's Amanda Hoyle. We need to let the builders take the risk and build these homes to increase supply. Supply of existing homes for sale will inevitably dwindle because families are not moving. To accommodate the work-from-home initiatives, they are expanding and reorganizing their homes. One thing is for certain, there is going to be sprawl. While destiny provides efficiency, COVID-19 certainly has changed the overall macro conversation about people living on top of each other. Just ask New York and San Francisco. Our municipalities need to be ready to build the infrastructure like water and sewer so the thousands of people moving in every year can find homes they can actually afford. When home values go up 30% in 4 years and median household income is up a mere 5% during the same time, we have a problem. Our housing market needs a breather before we lose talent and jobs to cities such as Austin and Nashville. And in turning to the general news stories in the Triangle Business Journal, the first headline, documents detail the pursuit of CRO. Incentives were essential to getting an expansion in Durham. This article is written by Lauren Onasorge. When North Carolina was trying to reel in nearly 900 jobs from a Durham-based contract research organization, big incentives came into play. More than 600 pages of public records show how a nearly $19 million incentives package helped lure BioAgilytics' massive expansion project away from a competing offer in Boston. The records, communications, and other documents related to the firm's recruitment, released by the North Carolina Department of Commerce through a Triangle Business Journal request, show a concerted rally by the state to secure the October announcement. BioAgilytics would invest $61.5 million and 878 jobs in a new headquarters. The state ended up approving an $18.8 million job development investment grant for the project. That beat two sites in the Boston area, Woburn and Bedford, that offered packages that ranged between $5.1 million and about $16 million, records show. Jim Dayton, CEO of BioAgilytics, says the process was more nuanced than the records suggest. Our decision to keep our headquarters and the corresponding job growth here in Durham County versus moving it to the greater Boston area wasn't easy at all, he says. What it came down to was facility acquisition and build-out costs, as well as community support for growing a CRO-ready talent pool. Dayton says the size of the economic development incentives was a factor, but not the lone deciding one. In a very real sense, both locations came out as winners here since we remain committed to growing our Boston-based lab and team at a pace necessary to support our many Boston-based clients, he says. The lab-based contract research organization, referred to as Project Iron Man in public records, already has about 350 employees in Durham County. Catawba Indians plan casino in Kings Mountain. This article is written by Colin Hughley. A major hurdle for the Catawba Indian Nation's $273 million casino project in Kings Mountain has been cleared. The tribe says it has reached an agreement with state leaders for a Class 3 gaming compact, which allows high-stakes table games and slot machines at the project. The agreement, which was approved by Governor Roy Cooper, will now go to the U.S. Department of the Interior for final approval. A representative for the tribe told Charlotte Business Journal the Catawbas do not anticipate any issues on that front. Securing the compact is critical for the Catawbas because without it, the tribe could only have Class 1 and Class 2 gaming at the casino. Class 2 gaming includes bingo and non-banked card games, according to the American Gaming Association. The Catawbas are only the second group in North Carolina to receive a compact for Class 3 gaming, the other being the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, which owns two casinos in western North Carolina. In addition to the ability to conduct traditional casino-style gambling, the compact also included a revenue-sharing agreement between the Catawbas and the state. Tribal Administrator Elizabeth Harris says the agreement is similar to the Cherokee Compact. The state will receive a percentage of the tribe's live table gaming revenue, which Harris says is expected to reach $5 million to $10 million per year. The tribe will also place $1 million into a fund to support federal and state-recognized tribes and assist local communities with economic development projects. Harris says the fund is expected to reach a value of $7.5 million per year upon full build-out of the casino, she says. South Korean firm grabs Charlotte property for $201 million. An uptown office building in Charlotte that is fully leased to Wells Fargo & Company has sold. South Korean investment firm Hana Alternative Asset Management acquired the 358,414-square-foot building at 300 South Brevard Street on January 21 for $201 million. Hana paid about $560 per square foot for 300 South Brevard, which it purchased from Stream Realty Partners out of Dallas, Texas. 300 South Brevard is at the corner of South Brevard Street and East Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. Hana Alternative Asset Management is part of Hana Financial Group, one of the largest financial institutions in South Korea and headquartered in Seoul. It's the first acquisition in the Carolinas for Hana. Charlotte and the Carolinas have landed on the radar screen for more foreign investors in recent years. Historically, those groups looked at gateway cities like New York for real estate investments in the U.S. Hana sees Charlotte as a growth market and wanted to invest in credit and term, says Fred Arena, CEO of Vision Properties. CBRE sent out a call for offers for the property in mid-March, says Patrick Gildea, vice chairman at CBRE, but the process was subsequently paused. Gildea says several South Korean groups were interested in the property. He says foreign capital has increasingly looked in the Carolinas for office properties with a long-term lease to a single credit tenant. The debt markets are very favorable for that type of property, Gildea says. With interest rates as low as they are, I think it's boosted pricing. For single-tenant credit deals, pricing is back to, if not above, pre-COVID levels. Wells Fargo leases all of the office space, and Middle Sea Jazz Club and the Public House, a restaurant that hasn't opened yet, occupy the retail space. The building was previously AT&T Plaza before the company moved to the suburbs. Stream acquired it in 2015 for $45.5 million and spent $15 million plus dollars on extensive renovations. Wells took all of the building's office space in 2019 in conjunction with an exit of several floors at nearby One Wells Fargo Center, which Vision owns. Belk plans to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Belk plans to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in a pre-negotiated deal that will reduce $450 million in debt. The Charlotte-based retailer's financial woes have been reported in recent weeks, with the possibility of bankruptcy looming. The proposed restructuring includes the debt reduction as well as commitments for $225 million of new capital. Under terms of the agreement, Belk's nearly 300 stores across 16 southeastern states will remain open and business operations will continue as normal. Sycamore, a New York-based private equity firm, has agreed to those terms along with holders of more than 75% of its first lien term debt and 100% of its second lien term debt. The 133-year-old department store chain expects to complete the financial restructuring transaction through an expedited reorganization by the end of February. Sycamore will retain majority control of Belk. And that article was from the Charlotte Business Journal. Greensboro Senior Living Community sells for $17.6 million. A senior living community in an upscale area of Greensboro has sold for $17.58 million in a transaction recorded January 25. SJV 1 Greensboro LLC, controlled by Brookfield Asset Management of New York City, bought Brighton Gardens from an LP listing the Irvine, California address of Healthpeak Properties, a real estate investment trust that invests in healthcare assets. Brighton Gardens provides assisted living, Alzheimer's and memory care, hospice relationships, and short-term stays. Brighton Gardens is operated by Sunrise Senior Living, which operates 320 senior facilities in the U.S., Canada, and the United Kingdom. Built in 1997 on 6 acres, Brighton Gardens sold for $13.8 million in 2003, and its total assessed value is listed as $10.14 million by Guilford County. Senior care facilities have appreciated significantly in recent years, and several new senior living communities are planned in the Triad. And that article was from the Triad Business Journal. And now we'll return to the Viewpoint page to read the column written by John Hood, who is chairman of the John Locke Foundation. The headline of the Viewpoint article column, Build on North Carolina's Core Strengths. When will North Carolina's economy return to normal, or at least to a new normal? Unfortunately, that destination is many months away, if not years. Still, we'll know we're making progress when we can see the most damaging events of 2020 only in our rearview mirrors. For example, entrepreneurs, investors, and consumers won't return to normal economic activity until the worst excesses of our radicalized politics are a bad memory instead of an immediate worry. That means no more mobs employing trespass, vandalism, or violence to pursue their ends, whatever those ends may be. And North Carolina's economy won't return to some semblance of normalcy until the COVID-19 pandemic is significantly suppressed, an outcome possibly only when a critical mass of the population has either been vaccinated against the virus or already contracted it. As dark as the past few months have been, many North Carolinians have lost jobs, incomes, family, friends, social networks, and even their lives. We need to keep reminding ourselves that it will get better. We will recover. We will rebuild. As we do, let's capitalize on our state's pre-existing strengths. North Carolina remains a great place to live, work, and visit, and do business. On that latter point, I have been studying a recent piece by a research team from Arizona State University. Their Doing Business North America 2020 report gathered a range of data for 130 cities spanning the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Would you care to guess which North American city ranked number one in ease of doing business? Believe it or not, it was our capital city, Raleigh. The other two North Carolina cities included in the study also ranked above the U.S. average and significantly above the continental average, Charlotte, number 38, and Greensboro, number 35. The rankings reflect scores in six different categories: starting a business, employing workers, getting electricity, land and space use, paying taxes, and resolving insolvency. North Carolina's largest cities didn't rank well in all categories, but as a whole, they fared better than cities with higher permitting requirements, labor market rigidity, tax burdens, and electric rates. Of course, what is good can always be better. Business owners in North Carolina will tell you it takes too long to get permits approved and to resolve disputes in our courts. Resurgent crime rates are making some neighborhoods unattractive places to build or expand businesses. Traffic congestion is a major problem in some areas, while poor quality roads and bridges are major problems in others. Disparities in educational opportunity and skills development remain far too wide. As an advocate of economical government, the rule of law, and choice and competition in public services, I think there are practical ways to address these long-standing challenges. In regulatory policy, for example, North Carolina's state agencies and local governments should pay more attention to the needs of new and small businesses, which often lack the compliance staff and experience that more established firms possess. We live in a beautiful state full of natural resources and strong institutions. As Americans rethink where they want to live, work, and retire in the aftermath of the COVID-19 pandemic, North Carolina will be a net importer, not exporter, of the ultimate resource, human beings. Let's make our new normal a better version of the great state we already are. And now we turn to the small business section to read a column on career advice. The headline: improve your work habits to help your career. And this is written by Billy Arsement. Looking to get a jump start over COVID? Would you like to improve your chances for greater success with your career in 2021? Here are 10 tips. 1. Increase your knowledge base. Too many, once they start working, get comfortable and begin to coast through their day. Wrong strategy. Commit to learning something new every day. If you go to bed as ignorant as you were when you woke up, you will be behind tomorrow. So design and commit to making learning an integral part of your life every day. I am responsible. You must take responsibility to continue learning and improving career opportunities. And due to time, we'll just read the rest of the 8 work habits. 3, make the commitment. 4, become a valuable asset. 5, be accountable. 6, continuous improvement is the only path. 7, it's a career, not a job. 8, be aware of the priorities of your employer. 9, become a solution finder. And 10, you always work for yourself. And we're going to stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-8225. 5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.